You're nobody till somebody loves you. You're nobody till somebody cares. You may be king, you may possess the world and its gold, but gold won't bring you happiness when you're growing old. The world still is the same, you never change it. As sure as the stars shine above, you're nobody till somebody loves you. So find yourself somebody to love. Same, you never change it. As sure as the stars shine above, well, you're nobody till somebody loves you. So find yourself somebody.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Chris Atkinson.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the second day of the PDC. It really is great to have you with us again. It's really great to see you again. Just great. Wow! Yesterday was quite a blast, wasn't it? Wow, we certainly covered a lot of ground yesterday. We kind of started off yesterday morning, kind of with Frank Sinatra, kind of slow. And then Paul Moritz came on and we started to walk into like a fast walk. Then Shu Chuck and Mark Anders came on and we started to break into a gentle jog. And then... Anders Halsberg came on. We were jogging by that time. We were running. Whoa, 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 whoa. And then Dave came on. We ran towards the end. The sprint. Woo! We did it. Woo! I'm sorry. I couldn't resist that. It's not every day you get your own band. Haven't these guys been great? Felix and the Buzzcats, I'm going to give them a plug. Thanks, Felix. Great, great work. Whew. So yesterday, I started off and I said, wow, this really is going to be a very significant PDC. This is going to be as significant as the first PDC we had with Windows. And I certainly hope after what you saw yesterday that you agree with that. We basically crammed 3 years of development work into just like one day. And I hope we didn't confuse too many of you. I also said that what I wanted to do with my team was just really impart a sense of the enthusiasm that we have. The enthusiasm for the simplicity, the elegance, the power, and the opportunity of the .NET platform. So I hope that we really got that across to you yesterday. Now I kind of like went out in the audience and had a chat with a bunch of you, so I probably surprised a few of you. You're probably walking down the corridor and this guy taps you on the shoulder and goes, what did you think of it? We're doing okay? Do you get the enthusiasm? Do you get it? And you go, who's this guy? What's he tapping me on the shoulder for? But the feedback was just great. And as the day went on, the enthusiasm built. So it was just tremendous. And I can tell you, imagine what it feels like for the developers at Microsoft. I mean, you're all developers. You know what it's like when someone appreciates your code. These guys have spent probably 3 years back in building 42 and building 41, coding away, wondering if you guys are going to like it or not. And then Anders Halsberg comes on and he goes, okay, let me talk to you about some of the key features of the .NET platform. And you were kind enough to give him some spontaneous rounds of applause. Thanks for doing that. That's just great. And the video link back to campus, you can see the developers there going, hey, they like it. They like it. It's worth all the hard work. So thanks for doing that. It's really great. And you've really helped the energy levels here. I mean, we just were so pumped. It was a great day. We just pumped. Now, the other thing I did was I went around the exhibition center and I spoke to a bunch of people there. And someone said to me, you know, this really is a breakthrough, Chris. Now, you can use the word breakthrough lightly, but I think in this case, he was spot on. But the difference between this breakthrough and other breakthroughs is this is a breakthrough where you are at the center. This is a breakthrough that's all about your skills. This is a breakthrough that's about taking your skills into an internet standards-based world of web services. This is about a breakthrough, about an opportunity that all of us can play a huge part in. I was just tremendously excited about that. Somebody else I spoke to, I'm going to pull his card out of my pocket now, I don't want to mispronounce it, was a gentleman called Jose Cisneros. Now, I don't know if Jose is here or not. If he is, give me a wave. But Jose came up to me and he said, let me just say, do you remember that demonstration during Paul Moritz's keynote yesterday? Dave Menlin did it. He actually showed it using visualstudio.net how you'd built a doctor's calendaring application for the doctors, and then you'd expose it as a web service over the internet. And this would enable a business-to-business exchange to access the calendar of the doctor to find out when the doctor was available so that any spare time the doctor had could be used for other patients. And Jose came up to me and he said, well, I am a doctor and I now run a medical software company. And when I saw that demo that Dave Menlin did, because I got really excited because I can now really start to see how web services could really work in the healthcare industry. And I laughed. I didn't laugh because it was a bad idea. In fact, it's a great idea. I laughed because just a few weeks ago, we actually finished a video that we produced, actually just to show how web services and the .NET platform would work in a healthcare scenario. I laughed at the coincidence of it because we literally were preparing to show you that healthcare video today, just to give you an idea about, not from the developer's perspective, but how from the, you know, the patient's perspective, the world of web services would look like. So, let's show the video, and I hope that you will enjoy it. I'll introduce you to a gentleman called Steve Masters, and the video is called A Day in the Life of Steve Masters, A Businessman in a Rush. So let's roll the tape.
I get on the plane. When they make that announcement that you can't use your cell phone, well, far be it from me to trifle with the FAA. And then I realize I couldn't make a call if I wanted to, because I left my smartphone plugged in and recharging at my house. You know, next time I am going to duct tape two alarm clocks to my head, rigged in series, forming a sort of Cray super alarm clock.
It's a good engineering joke.
How can I help you?
Anyway, my entire life is in that phone. My appointments, my contacts, my phone number. Well, obviously my phone number.
Do you have your smart card?
Yes.
Maybe we can get your life back.
Can you believe I left my phone at home?
It's a real shock.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry, dude.
Sorry, dude.
Call Dr. Andre now!
Dr. Andre's office?
Yes, hi. This is Steve Masters. I need help.
Just relax, Mr. Masters. Would you mind if I verify your identity?
Sure.
What happened this time, Mr. Masters?
Bike messenger? Don't ask.
I see this isn't your first encounter with a bike messenger. Oh, I see you're in San Francisco. Now, do you have pain or swelling?
Both! And I'm a tad bit stressy. Sorry.
I can hear that. Do you need to go to the emergency room?
No, please.
Isn't there a clinic nearby
that accepts my insurance?
Let me see if I can schedule something.
Good, scheduling is good.
All right, Mr. Masters. You've got two choices. One, your managed care with 100% of your coverage has a clinic 30 minutes from you. Or your wife's safety first plan has a clinic 2 blocks away and opening in 15 minutes, but you're only covered for up to 80%.
Good, 80%, good.
Now, do you want to pay the remaining 20% out of your prepaid medical? You have $2,000 left.
Yeah, great, sure.
Can you approve Dr. Walu assessing your medical records? It will speed things up.
Sure. Can you send a car service like you did with my head?
Honey, it's on the way. Oh.
Nasty sprain, Steve. Bike messenger again, huh?
Yeah.
This is highly improbable.
Oh, took the words right out of my mouth, Dr. Walu.
Walu.
Walu? Sorry.
Yep. You have to stay on your toes in this city. I'm going to prescribe you something for the pain.
Good.
Pharmacy next door, okay?
Great.
You're allergic to codeine, so I'm going to prescribe meperidin.
All right.
You know, I think I'm going to give you morphine instead.
Morphine? Really?
Wow. Should be ready in about 15 minutes.
Good.
Watch out for bike messengers.
Ah, ha, ha, ha. Good one, Dr. Walu. Walu? Walu?
I agree with Dr. Walu. It doesn't look like a break, so you should be fine.
Oh, that's good news.
Okay. Thanks, Doc.
Oh, and Steve, be careful out there.
I'm being a lot more careful, I can tell you that.
So there we have it, the opportunity. Thanks. We enjoyed doing that. That was fun. So there we have it. What was in that video? I mean, we had a whole series of web services. Web services connecting the doctors together, the insurance companies, the medical providers, the employers, all of these web services orchestrated together into one end-to-end transaction, compacted in time, so that that entire process of getting the appointment could happen while poor Steve's lying on the ground with a mobile phone. Now, how long will that take today? That's the business opportunities that wait ahead of us in the world of web services. Now, talking about opportunities, the opportunities in the third generation of the internet are just huge. And here to talk to you about the opportunities that lie ahead of us is none other than the chairman of Microsoft and, more importantly, our chief software architect. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Bill Gates.
Thanks, Chris. Well, good morning. It's very exciting to have this group together and talk about the opportunities we all have with the .NET platform. At the heart of this is some very deep technology. In fact, a few weeks ago I was sitting around saying, geez, how are we going to get the kind of press attention for what we're doing here? I mean, this is really kind of nuts and bolts, some of it. You know, things like garbage collection. And you could never get the press to really have headlines about garbage collection. Well then, sure enough, Oracle solved the problem for us. They created the perfect contrast in terms of how they do garbage collection versus how we do garbage collection. Well, so .NET speaks to the idea of having a platform that partly runs on the internet and also runs on a variety of devices. The PC is the primary device. It's the most important device in terms of its richness, the creativity software that you have there. But your information, your security, all the things that you want to have access to are available on any of these devices. Now, where are we headed with this? Well, I think it's pretty straightforward to say that we share a vision of a so-called digital world, a world in which getting at photos, organizing them, sharing them, is very, very simple. Getting at the music that you're interested in, even paying for the music that you're interested in, becomes very, very simple. Even video, which is perhaps the toughest data type because of the number of bits involved and the speeds required, that should be something that you can move around and edit. If there's been a meeting that someone's in, it should be very easy to simply have a digital camera in that meeting. And for people who didn't want to spend the time to be in the entire meeting or weren't available, you should be able to take a clip or even search that meeting and find the clip and mail that around to someone just as a common thing so that people only spend time on the parts that they care about. Even note-taking is something that we want to move into digital form. There's a form factor that's part of this .NET generation, a form factor of the PC that we call tablet PC. And this will allow us to take that final frontier of your notes and actually get that in directly into the digital world and not have this break between where you're working with paper and you're working with the screen. Part of that is to make the screen incredibly readable. And we've done a lot of studies on this through our research group to understand what kind of resolution, what kind of form factor are necessary before you have the immersive reading experience that paper can provide off of an LCD screen. And working with partners in the hardware business, we will have prototypes of those tablet PCs by the end of this year and expect to see those out in the marketplace in the next couple of years. And it's really stunning when you show someone a screen that has that kind of readability, how they think about it in a very different way. You know, it's almost like how people eventually thought about PowerPoint versus using slides. But the effect this will have is far more dramatic than that. Well, in addition to all that media, we want to take the world of business and move it into a full digital form. And although there's all these numbers about e-commerce and how it's exploding, if you really look into a lot of those so-called e-commerce transactions, you'll find that in most cases, the matching of the buyer and the seller is not taking place because of the internet. They've found each other through some other means. Likewise, if the transaction they're engaged in has any surprises at all, for example, the product can't be configured the way it was originally ordered, or the timing isn't going to be quite right, or there's some big currency fluctuation that might affect how the business is done. People aren't using digital approaches to deal with the full transaction. For all those things I listed, they'll just pick up the phone and go outside that internet connection. And having those two different worlds, the non-digital and the digital way of doing business, leads to all sorts of inefficiencies. So getting it to the point where the full bill, the customer service, the complete record of the interaction, and dealing with those events can be done online, that requires a much stronger infrastructure. It requires things like BizTalk, where you can see visually how you're dealing with all the exceptional cases, and then even take one of those process flow diagrams and ask, you know, for this transaction, where are we? Or how many orders have come through the various points on that diagram? So for somebody who's non-technical, they can see what's going on with the process, have very rich views of the process, and work with it in a purely digital form. The revolution that this digital world will bring is far greater than I think most people anticipate. For example, office work can be so much more efficient. People's expectations about how knowledge workers get things done are way lower than they should be. Their creativity, their ability to come up with new ideas, to reach out to partners, this can be improved by an order of magnitude. The time they spend in meetings, the way that they renew their skills, the way they find that somebody else in the company has faced a similar problem before. All of those things can be improved because of having a digital framework. So even where we are today with the PC, with Office, with the networks, with the internet, all of those things are just scratching the surface of this digital world. But the applications have to be dramatically easier to write. If you go to a website today, a corporate website, a startup website, and look at the kind of code they have, the files, the difficulty of maintaining those things, the difficulty of operating the website, it simply isn't good enough for the expectations that the world has for all these systems. And so it was really over 3 years ago that we sat back and said, what kind of technical framework would allow these applications to be easy to write? And what kind of framework would span all the different devices that are involved here? And that's where the .NET vision arose. It's similar in many ways to the original vision of Microsoft. That's now 25 years ago, a long, long time ago. But it was a pretty simple idea. It was very focused around the PC. The idea was to get millions of PCs out there so that there could be a thriving software industry. When Microsoft was founded, there were less people in the software industry than are here in this room this morning. It was a tiny, tiny business because it was about very high-priced, low-volume packages sold on to mainframes. But our vision was that by having that large installed base, we could have a vibrant software industry. Even we didn't expect the explosion that we were able to foster by having PCs from different manufacturers be completely compatible. It started with our BASIC, moved in 1981 to MS-DOS, and since then it's been the Windows platform that's given people this choice of hardware, choice of an incredible range of applications. And it was all about empowerment. It only took place because we had a philosophy of low price but high volume. And the virtuous cycle of the more volume we got, the more software we got, the more the scale economics allowed prices to come down, that led to the PC industry. And it was that whole installed base of hundreds of millions of PCs that allowed global connectivity, exploiting the internet, to really come into the mainstream in a big way. Well, this PC digital era is something that's getting incredible attention. When Microsoft calls together a group of CEOs, it's amazing that you know they come, they take the time, and it's very top of mind for them. What are they doing with their knowledge workers? What are they doing with their website? How do they fit in to this new world where buyers and sellers find each other and work in a digital fashion? In the beginning of the PC, it was something that only a few people understood, and we had to be evangelical about what we could create out of it. Today, anytime you pick up a magazine or turn on the TV, they're talking about the latest startups. Sometimes it goes pretty far. You can't even get away from technology being in the media. Well, let's go ahead and take a look and see how everybody's talking about technology. So in the last 25 years, technology has gotten a lot of coverage. But it's clear there's a lot more that we can do, whether it's ease of use, making things happen automatically, or simply conquering these new scenarios. But the idea of a platform, the ability to write applications that work across devices from different manufacturers, the ability to have tools that are specifically designed for the new class of applications, that's, if anything, more important than ever. So here what we have is the platform moving to be not only the PC, but really the internet. And not the internet as we think of it as a world of simply browsing, where there's presentation is all that's really taking place. Rather, it's the internet as a programming environment using XML as the lingua franca to exchange information between PCs and all the other devices. Software itself is really transformed by this because the way that it's updated makes it much more of a service than the product that it's been in the past. Now, that's one of those things that's very visible today that IT departments and even individual end users are very involved in that's just got to disappear. Keeping the rich runtimes on the smart devices up to date is something that simply should happen without intervention. These devices will be smart. Now, this is in contradiction to some other people's vision that will go back to having dumb terminals. Because we'll have things like speech and handwriting, and because any of the information that you're dealing with, the system will automatically try to make available related information, the intelligence of the device will be working on your behalf. And with Moore's Law, the cost of having that very high intelligence will be extremely small. In fact, as we look at new devices today, like the tablet device, or having a screen in your house that is just sitting there to look at photos, it's not the intelligence that's expensive. What's expensive is the display and the network connectivity that you need for that device. So taking those smarts and making them work without user involvement is really a challenge of this next generation of software. The user experience can be improved dramatically. It's partly having the natural interface, it's partly having your information arrive for you automatically, and it's partly controlling when you're notified of things so that the system is using your time in the most effective way. And that's really a very new vision. It's quite different than simply getting your file system done in a very graphical fashion. So .NET is an evolution. You know, there's a file system in the Windows platform. There will be, in the .NET world, there's a store. It's richer than the file system. It's an XML-based store that's out on the internet. And all of the server information or information on PCs or other devices logically are replicas of a subset of that master information stored in the cloud in that XML store. The user interface environment of Windows was a very important part of the platform, things like the message loop or menu bars and how those things were done. This next generation, those applications are actually built on top of the browser. The browser becomes the user interface foundation. And it has to be a lot richer in order that even the most demanding applications, like the modules in Microsoft Office, over time can move over and be hosted in that environment and no longer have the boundary between those different applications because the browser becomes that universal canvas. And so there's many elements in this .NET platform, authentication, scheduling, storage, security. There's a lot of very powerful demands people have against this platform in terms of how does it preserve privacy. But the role that the platform played in the past and the role it played in the future is absolutely the same. The things that are built on top will probably be relabeled. Today we have a world of applications and websites, and we think of those as two different worlds. Well, in .NET, those become one thing. Some websites will be richer applications than others, but essentially everything that was an application becomes a website. That doesn't mean that the code doesn't come down onto the smart client. In fact, quite the opposite. The really successful websites will have code that comes down and integrates in with the creativity software that runs on that PC. But we'll relabel those to be services instead of applications. And so this is a big step. People have said, well, isn't there an analogy here to 1995? 1995 was a big turning point because the internet was achieving critical mass. There were a lot of companies founded around that. We had just shipped Windows 95. We were moving the industry up to 32-bit. And we held an event in late 1995 where we announced Internet Explorer, and we announced our whole strategy around HTML and the things we were doing. And very much to people's surprise, over the four and a half years since then, the work that we've done has really allowed the Windows platform to be continue to be at the center of what everybody's doing. The number of servers out there, the percentage of the clients, because we brought browsing to the Windows environment. But bringing browsing to the Windows environment was not a profound change to the development model. There was browsing and there were Windows applications. And sure, the clipboard connected them together, but they were not the same. In the .NET environment, we take the internet and we move it into the mainstream so that your programming, all your programming, involves reaching out to the internet to call other services, to exchange data, and to reach out to the storage that will always be available. Well, there's a roadmap here in terms of how we get .NET capabilities into our products. The products you've been hearing the most about at the PDC is Visual Studio, because that's the starting point. The framework that we've got there, the rich runtime runtime around it, that's the starting point for these .NET applications. The next two releases of Windows are where you'll see .NET really built into the user interface. The Whistler release of Windows is the next big one that comes out. That's next year in the second half. And there's really two things that are very exciting there. One is that we get the entire Windows marketplace moved over to the NT technology. So it'll be Windows 2000 Professional at the high end, Windows 2000 Personal on the consumer machines. And so whether it's device drivers or reliability or the richness of the security in the file system, that is there for every user of a new version of Windows. We've all been waiting for that. It's hard to transition people from an entire code base and get to this new code base. But for us internally and for all of you, I think that will help a lot with the kind of testing and quality that we need to do even better on. But Whistler is also where you'll first start to see the .NET incorporated. When you have files on Whistler, you'll be able to save them out to a Microsoft community site simply by clicking on an icon. And so the store in the cloud will be integrated into that user interface. When you create a password on your Windows system, we'll make it trivial to have a passport created for you so you can be authenticated against all the websites that use that passport authentication. The browser will be more central to all the user interface that's in the operating system. So Whistler will be a major release, not in the sense that Windows 2000 was, but in the sense of this roadmap that we're heading down. The release that comes after that, which has been codenamed Blackcomb, that's where we'll see the most profound change in the user interface. We'll move to have a pervasive type in line that will recognize the sentence that you're typing in. This is where we will really assume that the system has an information agent that's working on your behalf and filtering all the changes that take place. Black Home will not bring changes in the programming model. The new programming model is what you're seeing here. This is the programming model that we'll simply be building on for the next 5 or 6 years. A change like you've witnessed with what goes on in the .NET framework can only take place every 5 or 6 years. This framework is a much cleaner framework than we've ever had before, but it's also ready to connect up to the this XML world that these new Windows releases will usher in. One of the milestones in the Windows roadmap is getting from 32-bit to 64-bit. Now, many of the people here worked with us in the transition from 16-bit to 32-bit. And that was a tough transition because the 16-bit memory model that Intel had blessed us with was not a sort of natural linear addressing model. It was very segment-oriented. And there were some tricky things that forced on software development. And so going from 16-bit to 32-bit was a dramatic reshaping of the memory model. Now, fortunately, as we go from 32-bit to 64-bit, that's not changing at all. You simply take 32-bit pointers, they become 64-bit pointers. There is a new instruction set here. It's an instruction set that Intel and its partners like HP have poured billions of dollars into. And Microsoft has been very supportive of this effort every step of the way. We've helped in giving feedback. That's had a real impact. We're enthusiastic about this first generation of hardware that will be coming out before the end of the year. And today's a real milestone in this effort. Some of you may have seen that we were demonstrating Itanium systems last night. Now what we're announcing today is that for all of you who get Itanium development systems, we will provide the Windows software development kit for those systems. And so we're ready to have developers begin their work. Taking a 32-bit application and porting it to the 64-bit Itanium, you'll find is dramatically easier than 16-bit to 32-bit. We've done a lot of work on the compiler. We can flag special things where you'll want to decide which data structures you leave 32-bit, which ones you move up to 64-bit. So that's a very exciting piece of work. The importance of the 64-bit environment will build over time. It'll start up on the servers where you want lots and lots of physical memory to be able to do massive caching for databases, for websites, but then it'll find its way into a very high percentage of the servers and also down onto the desktop as well, particularly the very demanding so-called workstation type desktops. One of the key milestones for Microsoft is showing the world that this high-volume Windows-based platform can scale beyond even the lower volume expensive platforms. Not only scale, but also have reliability that goes beyond even what people have expected out of mainframes. That's very critical to us because this whole .NET platform, the transaction volumes that we'll be dealing with will really be unprecedented. And so we have been working to make sure that our web benchmarks, our mail benchmarks, every one of those is not just the best price performance, but the best absolute performance. And in fact, before this year, in every category except database, we did have the best performance. And so we've been very focused on that database performance. Just last week, we had an exciting development there, which was the certification of a new world record TPCC benchmark. And what that was, it was a benchmark that was over 440,000 transactions a minute. And this is over 3 times greater than any non-Windows system has ever been able to do. So in absolute, that is a real breakthrough. And what's it all about? It's about the philosophy of software scale that you heard Dave Reed talk about yesterday afternoon. Software scale is where you get no limits. Software scale is where you get no single point of failure. You can see here we've shown both the absolute performance, and this was DB2 running on Windows that achieved this benchmark. We've also done benchmarks with SQL Server. Due to a technicality, we're having to rerun those benchmarks, and we'll have results to report that will put SQL Server very much in the top two benchmarks worldwide, we feel, in the next couple of months here. And so the Windows platform, our goal here is very simple. We'll have three or four benchmarks that show, in absolute, there are no limitations to our platform, even when it's going head-to-head with Solaris or mainframes or anything else. And so our dedication to making sure this is the most scalable environment is one that I wanted to reiterate and share the incredible progress that we've had there. You know, Microsoft's over $3 billion a year in R&D that we spend really has a very long-term horizon to it. We track all the different parts of the system and how we're pushing those forward. One of the areas that we've made rapid progress in since the first release of the browser is Internet Explorer itself. And today is also an important day for Internet Explorer. Right as I've clicked this slide to come up, we're releasing onto the web the latest version. This is version 5.5, and it's really a lot of refinements in speed, refinements in terms of some of the user features. Most interestingly, perhaps, is the refinement in the way that you can extend the browser and let it do rich things. We really have a focus here on making it possible to get rich interactivity on top of the browser, because as I said, the browser is moving to be the presentation component of the operating system. Probably the best way to understand what we've done here is to get somebody from the product group to come out and put it through its paces. And so it's very exciting that we've got Michael Wallant, who's the product unit manager for IE, here to show us what he and his group have done with Internet Explorer 5.5. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning. Well, thank you. Good morning. Very exciting day for us. We're very, very excited to launch Internet Explorer 5.5 here at the PDC, because Internet Explorer helps .NET deliver the richness of Windows to the web. And also, the other thing to remember is there's a big old E in the middle of .NET. So we've seen more and more websites over the past couple years start to take advantage of Internet Explorer to create a really rich user experience. A great example of this can be found on a site called Halfbrain. Halfbrain has built Excel-like spreadsheet functionality, essentially using HTML and script. Very, very powerful stuff. Another example could be found on Yahoo, where they built a rich email editing solution on top of this Internet Explorer platform. So we've also taken advantage of Internet Explorer internally in our own Microsoft applications. Outlook Web Access, which will be out very shortly, actually is a complete email solution. It looks exactly like Outlook, written just with HTML and script. Incredibly powerful, something we couldn't imagine 5 years ago when you think about the presentation capabilities of HTML 3.2 and how far we've gone beyond that. One of the key technologies that kind of weaves its way through all of these applications is editing. HTML editing is one of the first things that people go to or think about when they want to deliver richness on the web. And I'd like to show you an example of how Hotmail actually does that. So I've logged into my Hotmail account and gone to compose a message. Now what we have down here is I've clicked on the rich text format checkbox and I've entered in some rich HTML. This is all done with HTML and script. Actually, the amount of script required on this page, it's about 20 lines of script. And you get immediate, rich HTML editing. I can go ahead, you know, and type away with full HTML support. All the UI here, all just HTML. Can select some content, make it bold, make it italic, make it underline, do all the cool things that you've seen HTML and dynamic HTML and Internet Explorer do before. Another couple things to point out about editing support in Internet Explorer 5.5, we've spent a tremendous amount of time improving that functionality. We've actually gone so far as to take the entire editing functionality in the browser and separate it into a separate DLL. And all of the interfaces that the editing service uses to talk to the primary rendering engine are actually public interfaces. What this means is that all the richness you see in editing, and if you actually go to our booth to the Internet Explorer 5.5 theater, you can see a lot of demonstrations of this, but all of that code you can actually repurpose yourself to create a very custom, rich editing experience that's tailored to your particular application. So the other thing I wanted to show here was print preview. Print preview was one of the number one requested features that we've had from all of you going on about 2 years, and you know, I guess we finally got around to implementing it. One thing I want to note when we go to print preview for this page is that we believe that we should eat our own dog food. Dog food is a really important concept at Microsoft. So this dialog here, this print preview, and you can notice I can, you know, zoom in, I can zoom out, I can, you know, change the page setup on the fly to make it from portrait to landscape. You'll notice that I'm actually zooming HTML. Well, we actually built Zoom as a feature into the platform so we could implement this dialog just in HTML and script. All the flowing ability, all the clipping ability, all that I've actually just done in HTML and available to you as a developer when you write on top of Internet Explorer. Thank you. So we've seen applications be built on top of Internet Explorer with HTML and script. And for those of you who had the wonderful experience to do that, you end up with these relatively large pages, 2,000 to 3,000 lines of HTML plus script, and it's kind of hard to follow, and it's not really easy to reuse. Reusing components turns out to be pretty difficult, and having somebody use functionality in the product when they don't know anything about the script you've written tends to be hard. So back in Internet Explorer 5, we developed a technology called behaviors that let you build custom tags, custom XML tags, to put onto the page. The benefit here is that the developer who writes the component and the developer who uses the component don't really need to talk a lot. You just put the component on the page and it just works in a very intuitive fashion. You don't have to worry about namespace issues and other collision issues with inserting and sharing script between pages. For Internet Explorer 5.5, we've gone a step further and really enhanced that component model to make it possible to build even more powerful components. One example of this technology that I'll show is what we call view linking. View linking, very simply, is a technology to provide complete encapsulation for these HTML components. Another key technology for developers who don't want to build behaviors out of HTML and script, but who want to write some binary behaviors and actually take the browser beyond what it can do today, maybe to build vector graphics functionality or other high-end functionality, is we've exposed a set of public rendering interfaces. So if you want to write directly to DirectX or directly to GDI to get the right experience for your tags, you can now do that. Now, the key thing about, well, why would you do this versus building an ActiveX controller or a Java applet? You think about an ActiveX controller as or a Java applet as an island or a black box. Everything inside of it, it owns. If you want to build a control that knows how to display Japanese text, a Japanese vertical text, one of the enhancements we've made for Internet Explorer 5, you have to write all that code yourself. Not so when you build a behavior. When you build a behavior, if you'd like to display vertical Japanese text font linked, it just works. Amount of code you have to write, zero lines of code. So let's check out one example of how this is done. We've actually worked with Macromedia, who actually builds Flash, to build a set of behaviors with Flash. And they've provided a set for the demo here today, and we thank them very much for that. So let's take a look at an example that they've built. So, go. Got the mouse moving. Mouse movement is an important part of browsing. Okay, so here's the Skytrix human resources application. Might be something you'd see in your corporate intranet, you know, the way you go to get your information about your 401k information and the org chart and kind of what you need to do to be an employee of a company. So what I want to show is two examples here of behavior usage. One is how simple it is to use a Flash behavior kind of built on top of Internet Explorer to do things that most developers wouldn't really understand how to do. And the second is, because we built this as a behavior, I'll show how interacting with that and working with that just feels natural and kind of working with any other elements on the page. So let's take a look at the first example. So we'll go to my 401k allocation page. So I see a pie chart has all my 401k allocation broken out with the percentages, and this is actually a flash behavior doing this rendering. So if we take a look at for the source for this, what you'd see in a typical scenario, kind of before, is you'd see an object tag pointing to a Shockwave file, and the developer of the Shockwave file would have to use the Macromedia toolset to actually do all the work there. It'd be really hard to reuse that in multiple situations. But instead, here we see a new tag, the MM Flash pie chart tag. Very intuitive. I built a pie chart, I have a pie chart tag, and I have a set of parameters that give me the appropriate values that I can plug in and use. So really easy to author, really easy to reuse, something you can give to a designer and say, hey, if you want this experience, this is how you drop it onto the site. Now, note that while this information, another benefit here is that while here we've directly coded in the parameters, because this is integrated with the whole entire browsing platform, we could actually be driving this from XML in the same way that we can drive arbitrary other content from XML as well, giving true .NET integration. Let's go back. We'll go to the next example. So we go to headcount. So here's another graphic. So this shows me a nice graphic giving me the headcount allocation for my company projected over the next 18 months. As I mouse over, I get interesting graphical effects telling me what month, and I spread it out so each quarter is in a different color. Down below, we have some HTML components, just a select, a combo box, an input field where I can type in values, and a button. So what I'd like to do is that this last month, August of 2001, it's currently showing that our headcount's at 45. I think that's probably a little bit high. So I'm going to go down to the bottom, type in a new number, let's say 35, and hit change. Now, it's not going to be very dramatic because it's just simple. What's going to happen is that bar you see on the right is just going to drop down very quickly. Click change. Click change. We'll try that again. Oh, August 2000. See, excellent. Thank you, audience, for pointing out my mistake. See, we'll choose August 2001, put in 30, and hit change, and it changed. So let's check out how that worked. So once again, here's the source for the headcount. We see the MM Flash bar graph tag with the appropriate parameters. Once again, that could be data-driven from XML as well. And then I have my HTML select, the selected month select. And then down below in my button, let's see how that works. So on my on-click event, I say headcount.all, which essentially selects the appropriate parameter, and it takes the value that I put into the input and just pushes it into the parameter. This works like changing any other HTML property on the page. You don't know underneath it's actually Flash and behaviors doing the work. It's completely encapsulated, and it's hidden, so it just works the way you'd expect. So we've used the same technology to make or to allow developers to build rich web experiences using ASP Plus. So the scenario is that you go in to your ASP Plus authoring environment, Visual Studio, use some new rich components, plop them down, and when you hit that page with an HTML 3.2 browser, you'll get an HTML 3.2 experience. Round tripping to the server, all the events handled on the server, lots of page round trips. However, without reauthoring the page at all, if you hit that same page with a rich browser like Internet Explorer 5.5, you get a rich experience because the server emits behaviors that implement the rich Windows functionality on the client. So let's take a look at that. So first we're going to check out this page in Netscape, Netscape 4.7.2. So we're going to go to the bookmark. And the example I have here is a very Outlook bar oriented component. So I go to this, I see here's my Outlook bar. I have, you know, people, places, and things. I can click on these images to potentially open up that image. So if I click on places, it essentially round trips to the server, the whole page flashes. I click on things, it round trips to the server, the whole page flashes. Not super interactive, but, you know, it gets the point across. If I had other content on the page, it would also be flashing and getting that round trip every time. If I go to the same example running in Internet Explorer, right? I see a component. Now, what's happening here is that instead of some HTML 3.2 with all the content coming down into the client, I get an Outlook bar behavior. So if I looked at the source for this page, I would see the Outlook bar behavior with the appropriate parameters. Notice that I get immediate mouse over effects. When I click on places, it immediately switches. It's not round tripping to the server. The events are being handled on the client by this control. The server is only sending the minor amount of data required potentially as I navigate to the next page. But this experience gives you the rich, interactive, immediate feedback experience that's the hallmark of a rich Windows application that our customers have come to expect. So if you'd like to learn more about how to build these components, there's a presentation actually in this room on Friday morning at 8 a.m. I know it's early. I'm not sure there'll be a band either at 8 o'clock to wake up everybody. But it's called Leveraging Internet Explorer 5.5 from ASP Server Controls. And one of the gentlemen on my team, Francis Hogle, is giving that presentation. And I think he'll give you lots of good information as to how to build components just like this. So all of the behaviors we've seen so far are kind of composite behaviors. They're built out of HTML and script to create that rich experience that you might want. But let's say you wanted to go further than what the browser could already do. You want to render your own bits because you're building those high performance controls. So let's look at something that Macromedia has done. They've actually gone ahead and built a prototype version of Flash that utilizes these rendering behaviors. Now, the benefit here is that I can get even richer integration with the browser. I can get nice layering and visual effects that I can't get just when I put ActiveX controls on the page. So let me register the new Flash component. I think all of you are probably familiar with this method, the dreaded batch file reg server. So I'm going to unregister Flash 4 and register the prototype. So there we go. People were concerned that you guys wouldn't understand what I was doing. But I said, no, they're developers. They'll understand Reg Server, because we've all done it about a billion times. Woohoo for Reg Server. Okay, so let's check it out. So now we're going to go to the rendering version of the Skytrix page. Now, right away you see it's just a little bit different. So we have Mr. Coffee Man from Seattle, who's ready to take a drink as soon as we interact with the page. Right. Can you all see Mr. Coffee Man? Okay, so as I'm mousing over the HTML, I'm getting eventing to my behavior, my rendering behavior, and getting rich interaction. Well, notice the rendering behavior is underneath the content, and it feels really integrated. So I mentioned before about XML integration. Here's a good example of that XML integration. Here's my very short, there's only three people in this company. Oops. This is actually coming from an XML data source on a server, so I get the people who are actually, I might want to look up in the phone list. Now, Flash doesn't know anything about XML. No idea. But we're getting this functionality integrated essentially for free because they've built their component as a rendering behavior. So I click on John Smith, I click on Lookup, and I immediately get the John Smith, I get the HTML content integrated and data bound to XML, kind of integrated with some cool Flash stuff as well. So your designers can create the perfect experience, but you can get the power of the platform with the great XML integration that we have to deliver that .NET experience. So let's take a look for the source for this and see how this would be done. So I very simply have my XML data island up top pointing to my XML data source. I then have my Macromedia Flash tag, let me maximize this, and it points to the Shockwave or the Flash file that actually does a lot of the rendering in the background. And then inside of the Flash tag, I actually have my parameters that are actually data bounded. That's actually where you saw the name and the address and the phone number and all that. It's actually getting it from the XML. Who's doing this work? The browser's doing this work. How much code did Macromedia have to write to take advantage of this? Zero. Just one more thing I want to show on this. Now, we've seen how we can get XML integration that kind of integrates data. We also can get really good visual integration as well. So I want to show this last example. So once again, this is a Macromedia Flash tag written as a behavior wrapped around some HTML content. So it's just regular HTML content. There's images, there's text, and there's some anchors. So if I click on one of these anchors, what's going to happen is that I'm going to all of a sudden integrate some Flash animation. But we're going to see that animation done in a very interesting way. I'm not navigating to a page or going to a different area. It's actually brought up directly over the text. It's alpha blended in a really nice way. It looks really sweet. But the cool thing is the content in the background, the amount of understanding that the Macromedia Flash component has about this is zero. All that we render for you. Thank you. So just to close, we've seen a lot, and I've talked a lot about Macromedia and the great work they've done, and we applaud them for that work. But you can do all of this as well. These are all public APIs that are documented and ready for you to use at the web workshop at msdn.microsoft.com/workshop. Very easy to do. You can go to the booth in the theater we have in the exhibition hall and get the great code examples that you can find out exactly how to do this and make your applications great. You can come to Francis's talk on Friday morning at 8 a.m. to figure out how to build these Visual Studio components that work exceptionally well. I have a special surprise, though, before you leave. When you leave today, you'll actually get Internet Explorer 5.5 CDs. Bill mentioned before I came out that we're ready to download. It'll go live at 10:30 Eastern Daylight Time for download. Bring the web to its knees again. We love to do that when people download our products. But for you, here, you know, we thought, you know, all these guys are going to have to dial in on that 288 line. That's going to be a pain. So we wanted to give you the special blue CD with Internet Explorer 5.5 and other internet technologies available. When you walk out, you'll be handed one of these, and you can go install it and make sure it works. You can file bug reports at our theater booth. I don't expect anybody to have to do that. So just to close, Internet Explorer 5.5 really builds on the powerful client development platform of Internet Explorer to make it even easier to bring the rich Windows functionality to the .NET experience. I want to thank you for your time and thank Bill for having us up today and announcing IE5.5, and say good day. Thanks, Bill.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is what sort of breakthroughs in hardware we're assuming in the .NET platform. And when we introduced Windows, there was a huge assumption that the processor speed, graphic speed, and memory sizes would continue to rise. In fact, a lot of the skepticism about the platform was that the machines of that time were really pushed to the limit. Well, here we have the hardware industry moving at full speed and providing incredible opportunities for us to run .NET on new devices. There is an assumption that bandwidth is going to continue to go up, that we're going to have broadband connections to businesses and over time to consumers as well. There's an assumption that wireless is very important. You'll see in a lot of the .NET scenarios, like the Steve Masters one you saw first thing this morning, that idea of having a small-screen device connected to wireless, or even your PC, the full-screen device connected to wireless, that will just be commonplace, a lot of the access will take place over that wireless network. The investment levels that are taking place to make sure there's pervasive wireless are quite incredible. And it's important to consider two forms of wireless. There's the wireless you can connect up to wherever you go, where you pay per minute charges, but there'll also be the wireless that's available inside your home or your place of work, where you won't pay per minute charges, and yet the bandwidth and the capabilities will be such that even video will be available over that wireless network. In some ways, that will be even more profound because of the zero marginal cost and not requiring any new wires. At Microsoft, as we put in that wireless network, people are carrying their PCs around, using them in a different way than before we had that connected up. Microsoft is very focused on privacy and security as part of this new platform. We think that one of the weak links in security today is the user password, the fact that it can be guessed, that it's written down many places. And we have to overcome that either through the use of a smart card or some biometric authentication. I would think most likely smart card, either contactless or the kind you'll swipe through the keyboard, will be a standard feature. And that the infrastructure support we have for that now should allow that to rise up to critical mass. The PC itself will be dramatically changed. The performance, of course, will continue to go up, and that's very important for the type of natural interface and automatic recognition that we have in mind in .NET. We'll also see the PC is very much a real-time communications platform. There's been an explosion of instant messaging. There are a lot of people who've discovered NetMeeting as a feature in Windows and use that very effectively. But that's really only the beginning of real-time communications. We're going to make that such a standard thing and so easy to move from your asynchronous to your synchronous communications and edit documents together and share videos as part of that, that a very high percentage of time on the PC will be this new category of real-time connections. Part of that is that we'll have the microphone, a very high-quality microphone with lots of software support built into the PC and a camera as well. So enabling it for those scenarios without having to go out and get any type of add-on. I've talked a little bit about the tablet PC, but the point about the screen and flat screens goes beyond just the tablet PC. Even on your desk, you'll be using mostly a flat screen, and in some cases it'll be very large, the size of the desk itself. When you have that kind of flat screen, the ability to do direct manipulation, to point at things, to annotate things, to delete things, to tag something with a voice note, that becomes extremely natural, even better than what we've had with CRTs. The small screen devices and the large screen PCs will be complementary to each other. You won't be doing your homework or your tax return or your latest memo or analyzing your sales results on the small screen device. But you will have that wherever you go. And so seeing a message, looking at a schedule, looking at a map, those things will be very common on the small screen device. The market for these devices will not explode without the .NET platform, because the manual work of moving your preferences around and setting these different things up, it's just too hard unless you can talk to the platform anytime you get a new device or connect up with a new carrier and have all your information and customization come down as is appropriate to that device's capabilities and its screen size. Finally, of course, in the data centers, we'll be having these software-scale 64-bit Windows-based systems that will make people able to rely on all these connections without even thinking about the fact that there's an infrastructure back there, in the same way that they rely on electricity or water as very reliable infrastructures today. From the user's point of view, a lot of it will be far more communication-centric. The fact that you can access your information anywhere, but also that when anything changes, somebody wants to page you, wants to send you a piece of mail, a stock price changes a certain amount, a flight is delayed, you'll be able to set up your rules for when those things are worth interrupting you. And at different types of day on different devices, those rules will vary. But the system will be able to infer quite a bit. It'll see if you've been active on your PC. It'll be able to look at your schedule. And so you'll be back in control. This phenomenon that the latest email that comes in is what grabs your attention, or that you get all this junk mail, or that you have to go out to various sites to see what might be new and interesting, that can be changed. And this agent will be very, very programmable. Developer applications will provide information into it so that users get what they want there. Annotations will be very pervasive in this environment, being able to search for those, see which of those have come in, have rich views of those things. Really goes back to some of the original vision about what hypertext could be and collaboration around hypertext. And as I've said, although the keyboard continues to be important, speech input and handwriting will be equally important, and making it so that people can set their applications up so they can bind applications' capabilities to the spoken sentences. That's part of the extended .NET framework that will make it easy to connect up to Natural Interface. For developers, there's some new things that come in this era. We showed the idea of being able to diagram out exactly how your applications work across the internet with other applications. That type of orchestration environment, when combined with the XML schema mapping that we'll have, the XML runtime type capabilities, mean that writing the kind of glue software that makes two systems talk to each other will be an order of magnitude easier than it's been in the past. In the same way that report presentation type applications became very straightforward, no longer were a big issue in terms of applications backlog, here, glue software is something that the XML environment, along with visual orchestration, will really reduce the percentage of consulting and resources that have to go into that layer, freeing up those capabilities to do richer applications that are being demanded. The idea that the platform is something that runs on a client with its intelligence, connected up to a corporate server that connects up to the services in the internet, that three-level platform will change how developers think of writing their applications. The applications will be deployed and completely up to date simply by using the infrastructure. In fact, any application you write, there'll be services out there that you just make one click and boom, it's hostable, including making sure that the way it uses resources don't interfere with other applications that might be hosted on the same server or on the same services environment. One thing that we've talked about, and it's a very important issue here, is the openness of what we're doing with this framework. There's no single language that covers people's future needs. There's no single language that people are going to convert all their existing application code into. No language is going to stand still. Simply the arrival of XML itself is a milestone that for any vibrant language, you should have lots of people proposing extensions in very open ways for many companies to be involved in making sure those extensions get done. And so we're language neutral. Every language that you're interested in, we will make sure that either we or a third party have a great development connection to this framework for that kind of development. And so the extensibility we've put in is something that we've actually been talking with third parties about to make sure that we've got that right. And we picked a very diverse set of languages to talk to people about to make sure that we weren't missing something so that no matter what happens in this world of invention at languages and so many other levels, that the .NET framework would be able to encompass that. So we've got over 100 third-party code partners that we've been talking to. One of the most interesting is a company called ICE. And I'm really excited about the stuff they're doing. In fact, today it's great that we've got Dr. Bertrand Meyer here. He's not only involved in some very exciting language things, he's a very global person, being a professor in Australia. He's originally from Europe. He's got this exciting company that's actually based in California. So here to talk a little bit about how he sees the .NET framework is the president of ISE, Dr. Bertrand Meyer. Let's welcome him. Morning.
Good morning, Bill.
How are you?
I'm fine. The reason I'm here is that my company, ISE, has had the privilege of working with Microsoft for the past year to make a version of our tools and our language available on the .NET framework. It's ready for release today, not an announcement, a release at the PDC, and we're tremendously excited about the .NET technology. What we are best known for, as Bill just recalled, is the programming language Eiffel, the associated software engineering method, because it's more than a language, it's a method, and the supporting development environment ISE Eiffel. Now, I'm not going to tell you that much about Eiffel because there's a session about it this afternoon at 4:30. But one thing we have really become, I think, pretty good at over the years is to port it to a number of different platforms and to interface it with all kinds of languages and environments. Now, interfacing, this is the key word in today's enterprise world. Beyond a certain size, there is no such thing as a single language solution. Even if you have the best language in the world, and I'll just let you figure out where that might be, you have to recognize that your customers will want to combine it with bits and pieces from other approaches. This is a multi-language world. Now, what the .NET framework achieves, especially with its common language runtime, is completely unprecedented in the industry. It's letting everyone interface with everyone else at essentially zero cost. I know this sounds too good to be true, but that is what the common language runtime gives you. So for example, if you're an Eiffel programmer and see this great C# class library, this nifty Visual Basic control, this great COBOL module that you'd like to reuse in your application, you can not only access it directly without any idea, without any plumbing of any kind, but you can even inherit from it in your own classes, inheritance across languages, total interoperability. Now, people have been trying to come up with interoperability mechanisms for quite some time. COM went a long way, COBOL tried it too, but what you get with .NET is at a different level altogether. It's really a dream come true for IT managers faced with tons of legacy code, with lots of different languages and environments. It's a fantastic opportunity for Eiffel and for everyone else, particularly in combination with all the internet and web mechanisms provided by the .NET technology. So for example, we got ASP Plus only a few weeks ago, but in less than a week, we put together a substantial e-commerce application with just a bit of HTML, almost no HTML. The business logic is entirely written in Eiffel, and there's no CGI, no scripting, no plumbing or glue of any kind. And what's even better about it is that you change a couple of things, and you have a client-server application, not an application running in web mode, in a web browser, but in client-server at almost no change. So we're showing it in our talk, which is this afternoon at 4:30. It's in the room, I think, 312, and I hope you can join us to see the kind of technology that is already available today in the .NET technology. We also have a booth at the exhibition. It's right after the entrance on your right, so we're hard to miss. And I hope you can stop by and see what's already available in this, with this technology running to today. Another aspect that's going to become ever more critical in the years to come is reliability. For companies, what the web means is basically that you're putting your whole business out in the street for the world to behold and to use. But then unreliable software can spell disaster. Eiffel has this technique known as design by contracts that lets you produce robust applications made of modules that communicate with each other on the basis of precise specifications of mutual obligations and benefits, contracts, like business contracts between companies. .NET is the first environment that takes similar concerns to heart by letting you produce so-called verified code. One of the things we did in this project was to produce, in collaboration with Monash University, a contract wizard, which lets you take any component in the .NET framework at the object, at the generated code level, and equip it after the fact with contracts, preconditions, postconditions, invariants, the kind of things we are talking about in our talk. Now, the beauty of it is that it doesn't affect the source code. It works on the generated code. So it can be a module that comes from a language with or without contracts. It can be any of the languages mentioned in Bill's last slide. It could be C#, it could be C++, it could be Perl, it could be Python, it could be ML, and you can still work on it afterwards. And I do not know of any environment today where we could have done something of that kind. It's just amazing. Now, one more thing that I want to mention is how pleasant it's been to work with Microsoft over the past year. The support, the enthusiasm have just been tremendous. At some point, we mentioned in passing that some of the problems that we were facing in compiling IFO for the .NET platform must have come up in compiling C++ for that same platform. Well, even though that was at a rather hectic time in the project for everyone, before we knew it, we found ourselves sitting in a room with a C++ compiler group for a lunch discussion session, no questions barred. The openness, the willingness to help has just been incredible. So I believe this technology is visionary. I think it is going to change the way we write software. It's just in time for the age of the web and internet appliances. I believe that our IFO environment is the ideal way to program it, especially for mission-critical applications, the kind of things, the kind of space we're in, you know, space, defense, e-commerce, financial applications, healthcare, and so on. And I'm really proud that we have been part of this historic introduction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Super.
Well, IFO's a very innovative language. If you took the world of languages and categorized them in different ways, you probably wouldn't find COBOL and IFO all that close together. But I have to admit, I've written more COBOL in my life than IFO. In fact, I wrote a very large payroll program when I was young, and I couldn't get any computer time. The only way that they would let me use a PDP-10, which was the cool thing back then, was to write a very large payroll program. And so I got to know COBOL and the importance that that has. So that's another language that we've always said to ourselves. When we go out and survey developers, there's still a very high level of use out there. And not only is there that level of use, there's all of that code that's been available. And so we sat down with the leader in the market for COBOL tools and said, you know, could we get that tied into our framework? And so I'm also pleased to have here today, representing Fujitsu and the work they're doing, Dr. Bassam Kadam, who's the chief architect and is going to talk to us about what they're doing with COBOL for the .NET framework. Welcome, Bassam. How are you?
Thank you. So yesterday, you saw lots of demonstrations of ASP Plus working with languages like C# and VB. Today I'm here to show you how COBOL can participate as a first-class language in the ASP Plus framework. This is a really exciting new development for COBOL programmers. So the application I'm going to show you is a demonstration similar to things that you might have seen yesterday. It's a fruit list. Allows you to select a fruit, has a web form control behind it that allows you to select one of the fruits. In this case, there's a list of 5 fruits, orange, apple, mango, and a submit button that has an event handler that's hooked up to COBOL code. Now, I'm going to play around with this control just so you can see what it does. Now, the entire point here is that you can't really tell much difference between this demo and some of the things that you saw yesterday. And that's really entirely the point. COBOL can participate as a first-class language here and without any differences in the user experience. So the real proof of the pudding is in the source code that lies behind this. So now I'm showing you source code with a script block with the tag language equals COBOL. We think this is a really exciting new development. Thank you. Now what you see here is a bunch of COBOL code, and I'm going to scroll down a little bit so that you can see that, see the remainder of the COBOL code, and you can also see that the bottom is just ASP plus code like you've seen in other applications. It's exactly identical. It's just that the COBOL code is embedded in the script block. So what is it that makes all of this work? It's really tight language integration that the .NET framework allows. This isn't just language interoperability. It's true language integration, where you can do inheritance between COBOL classes and C# classes. And not only can you do that, you can integrate with the tool set that's available for programming to the .NET framework. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pop up VisualStudio.NET here. And what you're going to see is a C# class here, the main program, that instantiates a COBOL class, assigns it to a base reference. It's a C# class that the COBOL class inherits from, and then uses the virtual function call mechanism to call an implementation of the factorial method. Now, at the bottom, you'll see that in the Solution Explorer, we have both a COBOL project and a C# project working seamlessly together. So I'm going to go ahead and start stepping through this application. And you see the little output window popping up. So we start up the application, and we see the debugger pointing at the first line of the C# program. Now I'm going to step through to the statement that makes the virtual function call to the factorial method. Now, it's going to call, based on this code, should call the COBOL class and not the C# class, which is a good thing because this COBOL class has been debugged through years of use, while the C# class, which was written more recently, actually has a bug in it. It adds numbers instead of multiplying them. So I'm going to go ahead and step in to this code, and what you see is COBOL in the VisualStudio.NET environment. Thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and step through this program. It's a loop that computes the factorial of 4, so it's going to step through 4 times. And we come back to the main C# program, and I'm going to step over this statement that writes the result to the output window. So I'm going to flip over to the output window so you can see that we in fact did get the answer right. So what we've seen here is real language integration that's really exciting for COBOL programmers. Now, I know that a lot of you probably were hoping that you never would see another COBOL, line of COBOL code in your life, but but the fact is the fact is that there's an enormous installed code base of COBOL that's been estimated at upwards of 125 billion lines of code. So the question is, for companies, what do you do with that code base? You can either throw it out, or inside the .NET framework, you can leverage that existing code base, which we think is an exciting new opportunity. Now, the good news for all of you is that you're going to have a common set of tools and environment, though, to deal with that legacy code. Now, just between you and me, personally, I'd write all my code in COBOL. Now, Bill? I have a shirt here that I'd like to present to you that I hope you'll wear with pride.
All right, super. Thanks. We're looking forward to seeing a lot of language innovation around this framework, because in the past, anybody who wanted to do languages had to create essentially their own shell type environment. And so the barrier there for building that and getting people to adopt it really meant that very little was going on. And now with this environment, I think we're going to see go back to the kind of great pace of new ideas that are really required
when you get a class of applications that are very new, like we've got in the .NET environment. Well, let me wrap up here by talking about what we call the 2000 wave. The key products that we're putting out really are the foundation for this. Windows 2000, of course, is out there. That was super, super important for us. Office 2000 is out there. Exchange and SQL Server 2000 coming out this fall. BizTalk before the end of the year. Application Center before the end of the year. And so almost everything on here is pretty imminent. The most important of these probably is Visual Studio, where the only concrete milestone we have is the beta this fall, and then waiting to get the feedback to see exactly when we should go final on that. But these are a key set of products, and you can see the impact that XML is having on every single one of these products. You know, in terms of something like SQL, it is a fundamental advance, and it's pretty amazing how much they were able to get in terms of SQL support in this SQL Server 2000, and you'll see even more in those releases to come. The environment we've got here is one of pretty profound opportunity. In fact, for the people who have the kind of skills that all of you have, it's really just a matter of making choices about how you focus. We see .NET allowing development to be more efficient, more fun, trying out new tools, deploying things in a quick way, having customers who are willing to take the latest version because the frictional costs of getting that code deployed is so much lower. For system integrators, XML is a wonderful tool to let them connect things up in a way that was never possible before. And customization can be done at a level with the componentization that we've got here that was very, very hard before. For solution providers, people want to host. The idea of bringing together multiple applications and making them appear as a single set, helping the user out to simply think about a service that connects them up, that's really an explosive new business. For hardware manufacturers, these new generations of devices are going to allow for a lot of breakthrough work. The tablet PC alone is going to be a market that we feel will be even bigger than today's portable PC market. And certainly for the network operators, the kind of quality of service and just raw bandwidth that all of this is going to require is a huge opportunity for them, whether that's a cable company, a phone company, a wireless company. And so reaching out to them and partnering with them so that their investments tie into .NET is something that we're very, very actively doing. So looking ahead, Microsoft's basic approach, building a platform and then getting lots of innovative developers to go out and really create solutions around it. That strategy has been the same from the beginning of time, and now it's more important than ever. So we're very, very committed to work with you. It is about a new generation of software. There's a lot of new things for all of us to learn here. We can carry forward the code we've got today, but there will be some changes as we take advantage of .NET. And we can all be very excited, not only about the business opportunity, but the kind of changes we're bringing to the world. Making work more interesting, more efficient, changing the way people learn, allowing people to collaborate in better ways. And so the digital world is an exciting thing that we can make a reality. And I look forward to seeing how all of you can help us with that goal. Thank you.
Hey, Chris. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, I'm kind of sad now because this is the last time we're all going to get together. This is the last general session, but I'm now super excited because you've heard the PowerPoints, you've heard the talk, you've seen the demonstration. As John said, here's the bits. And what we'd like to do is they're waiting for you outside the door, so please, on the way out of the door, grab the bits, take them, work with them, and give us your feedback. And once again, thanks very much for being with us this PDC. And the breakout sessions start promptly at 10:30. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, the CDs are outside in the foyer, and we have lots of tables. Please keep there's lots of tables in the foyer. Thank you.
I kissed her and she kissed me like the fellow on set. Ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in the boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep, I keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. She's telling me we'll be wed. She's picked out a king-size bed. Tell me quick, ain't that a kick in the head? Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in the boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep, I keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. She's telling me we'll be wed. She's picked out a king-size bed. I couldn't feel any better, or I'd be sick. Tell me quick, oh, ain't that a kick? Tell me quick, ain't that a kick?
Hey, what a crowd, what a crowd. All right. I'm going to do something from the early days of what they now call rock and roll. This is an old Big Joe Turner song right here.
Now when I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. When I get the blues, get me a rocking chair. And if the blues overtake me, gonna rock right away from here. Well, when I get lonesome, jump on the telephone. When I get lonesome, jump on the telephone. Well, I call my baby till I'm on my way back home. Well, I flip, flop, and fly. Don't care if I die. I'll flip, flop, and fly. Don't care if I die. Don't ever leave me. Don't ever say goodbye. Give me one more kiss and hold it a long, long time. Give me one more kiss, hold it a long, long time. Well, love me, baby, till I'm feeling in my head like wine. Here come my baby, flashing a new gold tooth. Here come my baby, flashing a new gold tooth. Well, she's so small, she can rumble in the payphone booth. I flip, flop, and fly. Don't care if I die. I flip, flop, and fly. Don't care if I die. Don't ever leave me,
tell you don't know which way to jump. I'm like a one-eyed cat peeping in a seafood store. I'm like a one-eyed cat peeping in a seafood store. When I can look at you and tell you ain't no child no more. When I flip, flop, and fly, don't care if I die. When I flip, flop, and fly, don't care if I die. Don't ever leave me, don't ever say goodbye.
Thank you all. Enjoy yourselves in Orlando. Thanks for having us. We're Felix and the Buzzcats. Have a great time here. Thank you.